Good evening and welcome to another in our continuing series of programs about faraway places with strange sounding names. My name is Brian Koops, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague in the black with the gray hair, Peggy Wright. Our technician tonight is Eric Fisher. We're getting assistance digitally from Haiwan Wan. We're doing a podcast tonight. We began podcasting these broadcasts about 2 months ago. Brian Carson from Reference is here. Our speaker tonight is a specialist in the history of contemporary Latin America. He's a native of Montreal. He received his BA from Tufts University and an MA from Rutgers University, and this spring will receive his PhD from Rutgers University. His dissertation has the intriguing title I looked up, Land Without Memories, Jewish Tragedy and the Boundaries of Pluralism and Citizenship in Argentina. He's already received numerous awards for his research, including the Alfred Beaverbridge Grant from the American Historical Association, a foreign Canadian government award for research in 20th century Columbia, the Brooke Steadman Award in Jewish Studies from Rutgers University, and even a Colombian government grant for research on Jewish immigration. He studied, researched, and traveled extensively in Latin America, and that's included stays in Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, and Mexico. He's the author of several recent articles, including one entitled Rites of Passage, The Struggle for Jewish Intermarriage and Conversion in Colombia, published in Shofar, an interdisciplinary journal of Jewish studies. Professor Diskin joined the Department of History in 2004, and most recently he led a group of 23 WKU students on a trip to Yucatan, where they visited 6 different Maya sites and 4 colonial Mexican cities. It's really a pleasure, John, to welcome you to Faraway Places.
Thank you very much to Peggy and to Brian and to the Faraway Places series. And what we're going to look at today is a series of pictures and a discussion about Mayan civilization and colonial Mexico. Recently, as you can see from the dates over here, myself and Professor Drummond, Dr. Drummond over here, we took a group of 23 students to the Mayan Yucatan, and this presentation will focus on both the Mayan aspect and colonial Latin America or colonial Mexico. Depending on how much time we have, we'll see how far we get on the colonial Mexico if you haven't thrown me out of the room by then. This is just a map of Mexico, and the region in which we're visiting, the Yucatan, is the area circled over there on the bottom right. Now, the Yucatan is both a state within Mexico, and also the Yucatan Peninsula comprises a series of states. So by that, this area right over here is the Yucatan state, but almost this entire region, which comprises 4 states, is known as the Yucatan Peninsula. So for the purposes of our discussion, we're including those 4 broader states. This is a look at the map that we took, the route that we took. We arrived into Cancun on the top right, and we went to Chichen Itza, which is one of the most famous and visited Mayan ruins. From there, we went to the colonial city Merida, down for a visit to Uxmal. In the Mayan language, when every time you see an X, they pronounce it sh, so it's Uxmal rather than Uxmal. From there, we went to Campeche, which is another colonial Mexican site. Both Merida and Campeche were founded in the 1500s. From there, we went on a very long journey down to Palenque, and now we're in the Chiapas region of Mexico, Mexico's poorest state. And we visited Palenque, and then from there, we took a trip to another ruin called Yaxchilan, and then an arduous journey, 4 hours through the mountains, to get to San Cristobal de las Casas. And then we basically gave the whole bus lots of Dramamine so they wouldn't realize what was going on. And we took them all the way up to Lake Bacalar, and from there to Tulum, which is another Mayan site, and it's also the place where we kind of just unwound before coming back to Bowling Green. Now, for the first part, we'll talk about the Mayan sites, and then we'll discuss the colonial cities afterwards. And it would be useful to have a little bit of background on Mayan civilization, Mayan thought, Mayan geography, in order to better appreciate some of the photos and pictures we'll look at. The Mayan world comprises the area of the Yucatan, as well as areas into Guatemala, Belize, Honduras, and as far down as El Salvador. And next month, or in 6 weeks or so, Dr. Kev is going to be talking about the area of Belize, I believe, and stuff related perhaps to the Mayan as well. And so our trajectory, again, would be that way. Now, one of the things that you see with the Mayan world is it's basically divided geographically into three zones. The more mountainous area down south over here, the central area, and we got as far south as the central area, and really this central area with places like Palenque, Tikal, Calakmul, is the real center of probably the richest area in terms of Mayan architecture and thought, though some might disagree with some of the things that exist in Honduras. And this area over here tends to be quite lush and tropical geographically. And the area up north tends to be almost the antithesis of that, where it's very dry. There are no lakes or rivers, only underground watering holes called cenotes. So the discrepancy between this region and this region geographically is very marked. In terms of Mayan history, generally archaeologists, historians divide it into three time periods: pre-classical, classical, and post-classical. And for the purposes of this discussion, we're going to focus mostly on the age of the Golden Age, as well as when we look at Chichen Itza, the first of the ruins that we're going to come to see, that actually thrived mostly in the early post-classical age. And the classical and post-classical, particularly the classical, that's the time period when you really start to see the Mayan develop more sophisticated agriculture, irrigation, diversified crops, and then, of course, the monuments, the thought, the mathematics that is renowned for tourists and archaeologists, historians alike. Now, there are a few other pieces of information that I think would be very useful to just throw out there before looking at some of these slides. One is that the Mayan world was really divided into a group of city-states. So when you speak of the Maya, you're not just talking about one Mayan group. You're really talking about a whole bunch of city-states that formed this loose confederation through trade and indeed through war. They were often warring and fighting with one another, which goes a little bit against the conception, popular conception sometimes with the Maya, that they kind of lived in this socialist utopia. That was far from the case, and we can discuss that later. They traded all sorts of things, from jaguar skins to fish to jewels to vanilla, honey, tobacco, particularly in areas near Tulum on the coast. They shared a certain language. They shared a hierarchical political structure. They also shared certain religious beliefs and views of the what we can call the cosmos. And basically, the Mayans shared gods relating to things like rain, the god Chak, the god of corn, the god of sun, the moon god, the goddess of fertility, all sorts of gods. And they also shared a common view of the cosmos, which was basically divided into three spheres. You had the upper sphere, referred to as the heavens or overworld. Then you had the earth, and the earth they imagined as being a kind of a floating patty that just existed on water, and water was a big thing for the Maya. And the final part was the underworld. The underworld for them had nine different layers with a whole series of gods, and the upper layer, the heavenly layer, had 13 different layers. And that will be significant when we look at some of these structures. And finally, it'll be useful to have some idea of the Mayan calendars and Mayan notions of time. The Maya had three distinct calendars. One was the solar calendar, which was 365 days, but they didn't do 12 months of 30 days or 31. They did 18 months of 20 days. If you multiply 18 by 20, you get 360. Then they had an extra month of kind of a shortened leap month of 5 days. Then they had their ritual calendar, which was 260 days. That was 13 months of 20 days. And then they had their universal calendar, which basically tracks from the beginning of time until the present. And the Mayan date time, the beginning of their universe, as August 13th, 3114 BC. and it is a 5,200-year cycle of when they imagine the world will begin and when it will end, and who knows what will happen after that. Now, if you go from 3,000 BC to 2000, well, we're getting real close to that. And indeed, December 23rd, 2012, so, you know, go to Expedia, get your tickets, and so on. The Mayan world will either be collapsing and, you know, there'll be this major apocalypse, or it'll be quite a good time. I'm hoping for the latter. This was our, we're getting going here on our bus. Our great driver, Luis, who was just remarkable, so I figured he needed a little plug. And the first place we stopped at was Chichen Itza. And there are a number of, I probably have about 100 slides here. Some of them we're not necessarily going to talk about. We'll just flow through them. But this one, I wanted to give you a feel for the connection between Mayan architecture and Mayan astronomy, Mayan thought, Mayan mathematics. And there's very little that the Maya do that does not have some sort of symbolic meaning to it. And this one is known as El Castillo. It's called Kukulkan in Mayan. El Castillo is what the Spanish termed it, which means the castle. Four sides with staircases going up to the top. Now, if you had to venture a guess, how many steps do you think that this pyramid has? How many stairs do you think each of the four sides has? 13? You're fired. Four sides, think about their calendars, 365. Each side is 91 steps. That equals 364, with the massive one up on top equals 365. Other sorts of things that they did, and we can maybe advance to a different slide. This is some of the people from our group. And here on this one, you can see that if you count from over here, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now, there are two explanations for why you have 9. It could refer to the 9 layers of the underworld, and that's a repetitive theme that you do see in Mayan architecture. But what this one, I think it signifies is you have 9 on one side divided by the staircase, and then you have 9 layers on the other side. If you take 9 and 9, you get 18, which is the number of months in the Mayan 365-day calendar. Different interpretations on that one. One of the remarkable things about the Maya is, I mean, their ability to build these structures and the precision and harmony and balance in which they built them is sometimes mind-boggling. And one thing that we did not witness, because it happens on March 21st and September 21st, the spring and fall equinoxes. If you imagine this line going straight down over here, the edge of that pyramid, on those 2 days of the year, the way the sun reflects down, hits the pyramid, a serpent will appear going down the entire length of the pyramid over here, which the serpent is another one of the main zodiac and god figures within Mayan lore. We saw some pictures of it. It's remarkable, but unfortunately I have not witnessed it in person. Now, the walk up to the top of El Castillo is pretty steep, and myself, along with a few others, certainly had a few hairy moments. We won't tell you the really bad thing that happened. And here is Dr. Drummonds. This is the other faculty member who accompanied and led the trip with us. She's a professor in sociology. And this is the view from up on top of El Castillo, looking out to the Temple of Warriors, which is on one side. And then if you look out in the other direction, you have what is referred to as the ball court. And the ball court is something that is ubiquitous. It's present in every single Mayan site in different forms. It's one of it's a true joy to be on. Sometimes there's large, well, this is the largest of the bunch. Sometimes they're quite large. Sometimes they're much smaller. And this is what the inside of it would look like. It is always shaped in an I, kind of like the letter I with a capital I with the two N's. And you've got this field, and if you notice on either side over there, you have a little round hole. At each end of this I, you would have a place where the leader of each team would sit. So the leader of one team would sit here. We can't see the other one because it's over here. And the acoustics of these ball courts is so remarkable that they can speak from one end to the other. You're talking about 2 football fields in length, and they can hear one another without any microphones, which, of course, they didn't have back then. The judge or the referee would sit over here, and you can't see it from this angle, but There's a window right through there, and on June 21st, the sun passes directly through that square, just little additions within their world. Now, the purpose of this game was both recreational and religious. It was recreational in the sense that it was kind of like a combination of soccer and basketball. But not exactly like either one. And you would have two teams ranging from two to around nine players. This one would have nine. And the goal was to get the ball, which was made out of rubber or a type of local wood from the ceiba tree, and they would try to get it through that hole, which is about 25 feet off the ground and virtually impossible to get through. So that rarely happens. And the other part of the game, when that wasn't going on, was basically ball control, or as we Canadians like to say, puck possession, right? And they just tried to keep the ball away from the other team. They could not use their hands, and they could use, some people say their feet, some people say not, but generally speaking, they're using their hips. So imagine a soccer player who heads the ball with his head. Well, transform that image to just using your hips. I didn't grow up dancing salsa, so I won't try that one. But this game would go on, and the winner or the loser, depending on the situation, would often be sacrificed. Now, sacrifice within the Mayan world was something that was it was very prevalent, not quite like the Aztecs, who brought sacrifice to a whole other level and are in a different part of Mexico, but the notion of human sacrifice within the Mayan world really dates back to their creation. And within Mayan creation, there are three attempts at human creation. The first time the gods attempted to create people, they created them out of mud, and they found that these people were not able to speak, according to Mayan, the story of creation. The second time, created them out of wood, and they had no souls. The third time, they created them out of corn or maize, and sure enough, these people were able to recognize the importance of paying tribute back to the gods, and according to Mayan belief, it happens through sacrifice. Human sacrifice. So contextualizing it within that, maybe it's a little bit easier for us to grasp, considering how human sacrifice is viewed in 2006. This is just a close-up of those balls. This one is from Chichen Itza. This one is from Uxmal. And this is a sketch. One of the things you'll see within a lot of the walls, the murals, sculptures, are all sorts of different images engraved into these walls. And here on the ball court, you've got a picture of the god of the underworld, who is closely associated with the ball court because of a story that we probably don't have time to get into, but basically the underworld god had once summoned the god of corn to come to the underworld because he was upset that he was making all this racket playing this ball court sport up on top. He ended up killing him, and he ended up having two sons through kind of an immaculate conception, and the two sons ended up defeating this underworld god, and the underworld is known as Shivalba. So the underworld is closely associated. Here you've got an image of Quetzalcoatl, which I think we've got another one here, which exists at the base of the pyramid. Quetzalcoatl is something that relates to the Maya as well as other regions within central Mexico and southern Mexico. Here you've got images of warriors, and one of the things that people started to discover, particularly this Russian archaeologist in 1952, was that the conception of the Maya as this utopian group of priests and thinkers, and that they never warred with one another, was really broken in 1952 when somebody started to realize the writings of the Maya were not only ideographic, that is, not only pictorial, but they were phonetic as well. And we started to also come across images like this, where you see actual warriors and other images of actual battles taking place, tributes to the accomplishments, military accomplishments, to different rulers on stela or different statues. One of the most remarkable things at Chichen Itza in terms of astronomy and the intellect and ability of the Maya is the observatory. And the observatory, this is one of the sites in which they were able to figure out things like the lunar calendar, the solar calendar, get a sense of Jupiter and Mars and Saturn. and with unbelievable precision figure out the 584-day cycle of the planet Venus around the Sun. And they were able to literally down to each and every day, 260 days that star Venus would appear in the pre-dawn, 260 days of its 584-day cycle, it would appear like at dusk, and they map each and every second at which it would appear, and then the remainder is 64 maybe days in which it's located behind the Sun and is not visible from Earth. I thought some of you might be interested in terms of how the Mayan count. The Mayan cycle, again, is based on a 20-number system. And here you've got, they did have the abstract notion of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. When you hit 5, they would put a bar. So when you get to 6, it's 5 plus 1. And they keep on going until you get to 20. And then when you get above 20, it'll look something like this. So here we would have, this is the singles digit, this is kind of the tens digits, and this is, or the tens into the hundreds, and then this is the thousands. So we have one line equals 5, a second line in the digit, in the single digits is also 5, that is 5 dots of 1 equals 1 bar, and then 1. So here, just looking, if you ignore everything else, just looking at that, you've got 11. Then if you go up to the next section, because it's on a multiple of 20, this is 5 like it is below, but now we multiply that by 20 to give us 100. The 3 dots would be 3 times 20, and basically the same thing happens here, but now we go 20 times 20, which is 400, and I've just done the math. So if you had these kinds of dots on a mural, you would be able to figure out mathematically how much it adds up to be. And one of the things about this trip that really made it possible was how unbelievably great the students were. And I don't say that lightly. They were just a tremendous, tremendous group of students, 23 of them from 16 different majors. And Holly and I don't think would have enjoyed this trip one-tenth as much if they were not as exciting as they were. One of the things that you see in the northern part, in that northern zone, if you think back to that map earlier on, is I had mentioned there are no rivers or lakes. And the only source of water, and thank God that they had this source, and it's really the reason the Maya set up their civilizations in the northern Yucatan, were these underground watering holes. And these are just a few examples of them. Sometimes they did dump things like human sacrifice in there, Rachel and Stephanie. This was basically a sauna, a little schwitzer. This is one of those underground watering holes near the colonial town. We did not go to this one on our trip, but Holly and I have been there before. This is called Zidnup, and it's near the town of Valladolid. And we did go to this one, which is called Cenote, which means underground watering hole, Ikkil. And this one's been made a little bit more touristy in terms of the infrastructure. It's just absolutely stunning. That's us swimming in there. There's our Greg Louganis going. He's somewhere around here. There he is. Brent. And from that area, we made our way to Uxmal. And Uxmal is, the one beautiful thing about the Mayan sites is each one is very distinct from the next. So you can go to 5, 6, 7 Mayan sites and you don't feel as if this is repetitive or I've already seen that. And as soon as we arrived at Uxmal, that was very apparent to us. At Uxmal, it has an architectural style known as the Puuc style, P-U-U-C. And this is the temple of the magicians. Here's another pyramid of the magicians, and this is another. The story around this one goes that there were three hunchbacks, but the legend of the construction of this pyramid is that three hunchback dwarves built this in 3 days. Thus, they were considered magicians, and that's where it gets its name. The remarkable thing about this pyramid is there are actually 4 other pyramids that lie underneath inside this one. One of the things that's very apparent when you go to Uxmal, and sometimes, well, there are many things about Uxmal that we loved, and Holly particularly fell in love with Uxmal, is you'll see here that there are these faces, and I've blown them up, and on the next slide they'll be even more apparent. But if we just count these for a minute, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So 12 doesn't really mean much, but then this is 13. You figured it out now, right? And what these are it's the face of the rain god Chuck. And 13 are the layers of the heavens. And here's just a closer image. And at Uxmal, as well as Chichen Itza, because of the dearth of rain, there is basically Uxmal and another one nearby called Kaba. Almost the entire site is dedicated to the god Chuck praying for rain. And there are whole sorts of different ways in which they have these prayers. But you see one thing interesting about Chuck is it has a nose that is going this way. And sure enough, there's this local artist down there who was kind enough. Well, we bought it, but he was really remarkable. His name is Jesus Marcos Delgado, and then Ku, which implies that he is Mayan. And if you look at this one, the nose is facing that way, which means that they are thankful when the nose is appearing in that direction. They are thankful for the rain. When they have the nose and at different places in Uxmal, it's either upside down or upside right. And when it's like that, they are waiting or praying for rain to arrive. And there are so many Chuck God images at Uxmal that you would just lose track counting. Here's another with it this way. This is our group there, and we had a guest lecturer for 3 days, Enrique. He was fantastic, and he's of Mayan descent. And if you look over here, you can see that there are images of Chuck on the side, and this is a totally different place than what we were just looking at. This is known in Uxmal as the nunnery, or the nunnery complex, the quadrangle. It was named that by the Spanish. It wasn't the name provided by the Maya. And it's basically this quadrangle of four buildings. One of the things that's really cool about Uxmal is a lot of the other sites are dedicated to, particularly when we get to Palenque, to kings and figures of royalty. Uxmal appears to have a little bit more of a, I don't want to say common person, but a little bit more of a story about more than just a king and so on. And one of the uses of the quadrangle, it's believed that it may have been used as a university / education area in addition to other things. And just the artwork that you see over here is phenomenal. Then there is the governor's palace, and one of the things that people comment about the governor's palace is how absolutely sophisticated the architecture and design is on the upper half, and yet this part over here is entirely plain. There's nothing on it. And I can't remember the exact number of stones offhand, but I think it's 22,000 individually crafted stones, each weighing between 55 to 75 pounds, that was used to build this structure. And if we count here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and then there's one on that side, 13, again, the 13 layers of the heavens. The goddess of fertility, which faces the governor's palace. And then we arrive at the third major site that we visited, Palenque. And Palenque, immediately upon arrival, and I'm not sure this photograph really gives you a feel for it, but when you get to Palenque, it's hot, it's humid, it's pushing over 90 degrees in the winter time. We were there in January. I can't even not imagine what it would be like in June. And the entire area, the geography, very much dictates the kinds of things that you see there. There's not a single Chuck god, rain god, at Palenque, whereas they're widely prevalent up at Uxmal and to a lesser extent at Chichen Itza. This is the oldest of these three major sites. The golden age of Palenque was between about 600 to 800. Uxmal was kind of 800 going a little forward. Chichen Itza was around 950, 1,000 in that area. This is what we were initially looking at. It's either some people refer to it as the watchtower, other people refer to it as an observatory, and the debate over those two words is a little bit more significant than we might think. If it's an observatory, that goes in line with that pre-1952 conception of the Maya a little bit more. If it's a watchtower, that's laying claim to the military or competing vision of the Maya that starts to emerge in the past few decades. And this is called the Temple of the Inscriptions, which is this over here. And the Temple of the Inscriptions has one of the most amazing discoveries, in probably the most significant discovery in the Mayan world. In 1952, a Mexican archaeologist with a Rockefeller grant took a group of archaeologists into this temple and started to dig around. And over the course of some time, noticed that there were kind of a series of holes in this one large slab of stone. And they started to dig away at them, and they eventually lifted up this stone that only weighed 4 tons. And when they lifted up this stone of 4 tons, it led down a staircase, but the entire staircase was filled with rubble and jade and all sorts of things. It took them a year to dig down 23 steps. It took them another 3 years to dig down the remaining, I think, 73 steps. And when they got to the bottom, is they found the tomb of the greatest Palenque Mayan king, Pakal, who ruled during those years over there. And this is a sarcophagus, his coffin, basically, that they found. That you'll see an image of this pictograph a little bit later on. And when they arrived down at the bottom, there were 6 people who had been sacrificed, all sorts of jade around. The sarcophagus weighed 12 tons. So the stone to get in was the light part. And this is just it's not easy to get a picture of it, but I try. This is not my picture. You're not allowed going down there at the moment. We are hoping to sneak in by an academic pass, but the whole thing is currently closed for renovation. Sometimes they do let academic groups go down. And this was the jade mask that he had on when Alberto Ruiz found him in 1952. Pakal's tomb, his body is still in the Temple of the Inscriptions, but much of the jade mask and other such things have been transported to the National Museum in Mexico City. It's hard to get a really good picture of... This is the cover of that sarcophagus, and I don't know how well you can see, particularly in the back, but this right here is Pakal. And he's kind of leaning back like this, with his head going down. These are his front knees, so he almost has his knees up. And the idea in the Mayan world, when it came, particularly in Palenque, and when it came to a king dying, is that before a king can reach the heavenly world, the king had to descend into the Xibalba, into the underworld. And you can see, if you're able to make it out, the Xibalba god in this area has to go through all 9 layers of the Xibalba underworld in this brutal battle in order to emerge into basically the afterlife. And here you've got the battle between the underworld, the heavenly world, and this thing over here is referred to as the mother tree, or the tree of life, that Ceiba tree representing the cornerstone or epicenter of the earthly world. And there's so much going on here that I could not even begin to tell you all of it. I just don't know. People in Palenque who spent years and years researching this stuff have basically deciphered around 50 to 60% of what exists in Palenque. Now, what they found in 1995 next to that Temple of the Inscriptions in another temple is this picture, and here's a skull, and this is referred to as the Tomb of the Red Queen, and it's believed either to be Pakal's wife, mother, or sister, and this was taken to Mexico City. This is a photograph of what was unearthed. Now, at a lot of the temples around the Temple of Inscriptions, you see all sorts of beautiful colored pictographs, and a lot of the buildings themselves used to be colored blue and red way back when, but just have been weathered over time. And I'm not going to try to explain them all. I'm just going to show you a few that we came across there. A lot of them relate to the story of creation, which can be read about if you're interested in a book called the Popol Vuh. This is actually a penis bloodletting ceremony. And one of the things that we got to experience in that area was also the rainforest or a jungle tour. And we got to hear howler monkeys and all sorts of good stuff. So we found him there in the jungle. We decided to bring him along. And after Palenque, we got a real treat. We got to go to Yaxchilan, and there's just a few little slides. But in order to get there, we had to take a riverboat for about a half hour one way, and then the current and the wind made it about an hour going back. We had about three boats like this, and the unbelievable thing about going to Yaxchilan is as you make your way down, you're eventually going to get to the site, which is a half hour away. But all along that way, you're coming across pieces of ruins that you can make out in the jungle. And then the vast, vast majority, maybe 5%, have even been unearthed. It's a question of funds, time, workers, and so on. This is Yaxchilan. And this was our classroom. The other aspect of our trip that we focused on was, in addition to the Mayan civilization part, colonial Latin America and colonial Mexico in particular. And the places that we really visited in relation to colonial things were Valladolid, I don't have any pictures of those up here, Mérida, which is the capital of the Yucatan, Campeche, which will come next, and then we made our way down to San Cristobal de las Casas, which combines things both colonial and indigenous. And the conquest, the first Spaniards to arrive in the Yucatan actually arrived 2 years before Cortez arrived into Mexico in 1517. Somebody just landed there, met some of the Indians and left. And that did spur somebody like Cortez 2 years later to want to check it out a little bit more. Mérida and Campeche were basically founded by the Montejo family in the 1540s. So that's how far back it goes. And immediately the Spaniards set out to do what they tried to do in all parts of Latin America, and that was to basically eliminate things Indian and Europeanize or Iberianize things, make them look like Spanish in terms of cities, in terms of religion, in terms of economics, in terms of food, anything you would possibly want. So this is what a typical colonial Latin American city, maybe a smaller one, might look like. The central plaza, this is one side is the government building. There's a cathedral here, a municipal building here, and a government palace on the far side. And this is Campeche, and we'll come back to Mérida in a little bit. Campeche is a walled-in city, as we'll come to see in a minute. The cathedral, and on Sunday night, which is the night we arrived there, the entire center was, there was kind of music and fire throwers, and this is the walled-in area around Campeche. What were they walling it in for? They were walling it against English and French pirates, primarily English pirates. By the time they finished building this thing, the English had long ago stopped sending pirates over there, so it was a really wise investment, as was much in the Spanish Latin American world. But it's a really, really impressive, impressive site. And we got to, now not the whole wall is not standing, but large portions of it are. And this is the inner half of the wall, and that would be, on the other side, it's much more modern looking, and the colonial part is really held in within the wall. And the colors of the buildings are just, they really make you happy. A Franciscan church, much more modest inside than some of the larger cathedrals. Franciscans tended to practice a more ascetic lifestyle. This is the inside of what we can call a kind of a governor's house, a governor's mansion. And this is the front side of that walled-in city facing the water. And this would be the Pacific side of the Gulf of Mexico, basically. So it dips down. You have, from your perspective, Cancun, and then the Gulf is over here. Then it kind of comes around here, and Campeche is over here before it pulls back up. Now, one of the things that was striking, I think, for us is it was very clear, if you study colonial Latin American history, colonial Mexican history, the degree to which the Spanish altered and affected almost every aspect of the indigenous people's lives. As well, you might argue, African people's lives, in terms of how they built cities, building these things right on top of often Mayan sites or Aztec sites, if you're in a place like Mexico City. In terms of the taking away of indigenous land, in terms of introducing a mercantile economy, in terms of the demographic collapse of the population, what you might call the biological conquest, where you have about, in say the Central Valley of Mexico, 20 million people in 1519 when Cortez arrives, and less than 100 years later in 1609, you have less than 1 million. So from 20 million to less than 1 million in less than 100 years. And those sorts of things were things that we discussed a lot, but I think one thing that really struck a lot of the group was the degree to which the people in this region managed to asserted back then and continue to assert today elements of their own culture, elements of their own traditions and so on, despite, you know, the colonial experience being one that was largely unequal. And I think we see this in a variety of different settings, and one of which might be very minuscule, but I think it speaks volumes, is at the church here in Mérida. This is the main cathedral. This is a church built in the 1560s, the main cathedral in Mérida. And all this area around what is the center part, the Mayan are the people through a system of virtual slavery, are those who are building these cathedrals. And this whole area is a series of Mayan reliefs or Mayan pictographs that are embedded into this Catholic cathedral. So just subtle ways in which they combine things pre-1492 with post-1492 and what you might call syncretism, fusion, or blending. Another illustration of this, I think, is the story of the Virgin of Guadalupe, which some of you might be familiar with already. And both of my Virgin of Guadalupe pictures are not very good because the lighting was really hard. But you immediately see the Mexican flag is almost always by the Virgin of Guadalupe. And if you could make out the Virgin of Guadalupe over there, you will notice that she is dark-skinned. And certainly people debate and discuss, you know, was Jesus as white as he's commonly depicted and stuff like that? Well, in Mexico, the Virgin Mary is often depicted as much more dark-skinned than you would see elsewhere. And this goes back, the story of the Virgin Mary and the patron saint for Mexico, which is the Virgin Guadalupe, goes back all the way to 1531 when there was this Christianized Aztec. He had been converted to Catholicism. His name is Juan Diego. And he is walking around near what was Mexico's, or Tenochtitlan, near Mexico City. And he comes across this apparition of a woman who tells him to build a church at this site. And this woman was a dark-skinned Indian speaking the Aztec language Nahuatl. And she told him to go see the bishop and let him know about this phenomenon, this desire to build a church. He went to see the bishop, who, as you probably imagine, was not paying your average Indian too much attention, and he demanded proof of him to corroborate the story of this virgin appearing. And so Juan Diego basically got really embarrassed, tried to bypass seeing this virgin again, and she sought him out and appeared to him again, and this went on a couple times until he finally said, well, the bishop's demanding proof. And she said, okay, go over that hill and go pick out some of those roses. And this was an area where there were not very many roses to be found. And in his kind of poncho or frock, he collected a series of roses, appeared before the bishop, and when he unveiled the roses, according to the legend of the story, which is believed by, you know, millions of people in Mexico, a image of the Virgin Mary came about from those roses. And this became known as the story of the Virgin of Guadalupe. And it was significant not only because she spoke to Juan Diego Nahuatl and she was dark-skinned, but the exact site on which she was telling him to build that temple or that church was the exact site of the Aztec goddess Tonatzin. So there are all sorts of pre-1492, post-1492 relationships. And I think when you see the Virgin in all these cathedrals, again, I apologize for the lighting, but it's really striking just how something very small could potentially speak volumes. And when the when the Mexicans gained their independence from Spain, a Mexican priest by the name of Father Hidalgo stood up and said to the masses, death to the Spaniards and long live the Virgin of Guadalupe, which could mean death to the Spaniards and long live Mexicans. Maybe that's another way to interpret it. This is Juan Diego, who was actually canonized a couple years back, first Latin American Indian ever to become a saint. And there are all sorts of beautiful depictions of the Virgin of Guadalupe. Other places in which we saw this assertiveness or a degree of recognition of the indigenous past was at the Palacio del Gobierno, the government palace in Mérida. And there are all sorts of beautiful, beautiful murals within this building. that just line the walls here, and there's some outside. And just in looking at some of this artwork, I think you can get a little bit of a feel for a people, particularly in the area of the Yucatan, which maybe a little bit like Texas, kind of prides itself on having this independent streak, where they don't portray and try to wash over the very violent history that they experience. They put it out there really for everybody to see. Now, this might be a visual thing, and there are lots of elements within the day-to-day function that might not recognize this, but nonetheless, I think it's significant. Here you've got this Mayan rebel leader, Jacinto Sen-Ek, and he rebelled in 1760. He was captured, and to make a point, they ended up killing him on this table. I don't know if you can make out that one, but somebody lifting up this large bushel. This is Father Friar Diego de Landa, and Diego de Landa was a very interesting figure, and I think the fact that they don't portray him as sometimes they do other priests in an entirely optimistic, uplifting light. He was the one who was largely responsible for converting many of the indigenous people in this area. He was also the person who was responsible for burning all the Mayan books that existed. The Mayan did have books. They looked like extendable maps. They folded up like that. And four of them survive till this day. There are no Aztec works that survive, but four Mayan works survive. Three are in Europe, and one is in the Americas. And one of the ironies is he also then wrote a whole history of the Maya in 1560, and historians rely on his account as one of the best accounts of the Maya. This is just another really cool image of the Popol Vuh, or the story of Mayan creation, that exists on another wall. You can see the human emerging from the maize or the corn. This is part of that, it's almost like a triptych part on the left side. And here you see a jaguar and kind of the knight. And the story with the jaguar and its relation to creation, it's an important one, where the Maya believe that every single night when the sun falls, the sun transforms itself into a jaguar. And that jaguar then goes into the underworld, into Xibalba, fights with the underworld gods all night long, and much more optimistically than the Aztecs, who have a similar view, the jaguar always emerges victorious, and thus allowing the day to begin, the sun to rise, transforming itself back into a jaguar. And this happens every single day. And the final stop that we made that really speaks to this sense of kind of cultural assertiveness or cultural expression was in San Cristobal de las Casas. Now, Chiapas, where San Cristobal is the capital of the state of Chiapas. Chiapas is the poorest province in Mexico, or state, and we did not have to look very far. I think one of the striking things about this trip is some students would say, I think I learned more going to the bathroom on this trip than I did anywhere else. Because we would have to stop in certain places just on, you know, on the side of the highway and get out. There'd be three huts in this town. And people, you know, we'd ask, can we use your bathroom? You know, we'll give you some pesos. They're like, no, go ahead. And people head out into this outhouse, you know, a few people wiping out down the mudslide to get to the outhouse. Quite an experience. So you can see the colonial elements, but what's very unique about this area is while very colonial, it's also the region in which arguably the people there most hold their Indian traditions dear. And one of the places right by San Cristobal, 20, 15 minutes away, is this unbelievably unique place that you cannot even begin to get a feel for looking at this picture, because the picture itself really doesn't look anything unusual, is this place called Chamula. Now, the Chamula Mayan people are one that just, I mean, really, like, vociferously hold their Mayan traditions. And they practice ceremonies that date pre-1492, combine it with things Catholic. This is a church, and they consider themselves Catholic. And we're standing in front of this, and you're not allowed to take any pictures inside of here. And they literally will hang you right on the spot. Now, I cheated a little bit, not by taking a picture inside. I wouldn't disrespect them that way. But I did find a postcard that somebody had taken, so I just scanned the digital image inside. And this is part of what it looks like. And this is just a minor part. When you look at the area that they are facing, and maybe it would be helpful for some people here to give an attempt to what it was like for you to see what you did inside, you've got saints that are adorning the front of the church. And the saints of this one are St. John, and then kind of Little St. John, as they term them. And in many ways, the front does look like a Catholic church. You have the candle lighting element, though there are so many more candles being lit here. This one you can't see, but they often have all this straw and almost hay on the floor. And if you look on the roof of the building, there will be things like the Serpent God, a Maize God, and all sorts of things combining pre-1492 and way before pre-1492. And here you have Carnival in San in Chamula. And again, this is like Mardi Gras. And you can, if you think of religions, maybe like voodoo, something like that, that combine things African and things Catholic. Here, they're certainly combining things that the Catholic Church itself, or white Catholics, non-indigenous Catholics, would not be practicing. And then the final element, if all else fails, to remind you that the indigenous people in that region are asserting themselves, men and women, it would be the Zapatista movements, the Indian rebellion that took place beginning in January 1, 1994, which coincided with the implementation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And as the poorest state within Mexico, and as the people who generally get the short end of the stick even within this poor state, they were demanding a lot of the same things that this famous Mexican revolutionary dating back to the early part of the 20th century named Emiliano Zapata, that's where they get their name, Zapatistas, they were basically demanding, you know, justice, land, and freedom. Those were almost, you know, their three things, and wanting some sort of improvement in the lives of, in their daily lives. And they've kind of have this interesting accord that they've established with the Mexican central government, where the government kind of allows them a degree of autonomy, but doesn't really say that they're doing it. And the military kind of stays out of their zone unless things really get bad. And here you see them armed to the, you know, well, pretty armed. And one of the things that happened more recently, this is from 1994-96. In 2006, the week before we got there, the Zapatistas tried a different approach where they went on a 30-state tour of Mexico walking, leaving from Chiapas, going to the Yucatan without any weapons. They were on a peaceful tour of dialogue, which hopefully that sort of thing continues. And just a shot of some of the people there. One of the things that I think we don't realize about the Mayan civilization collapsed, and for reasons that people are still trying to figure out, whether famine or war or disease or erosion or other geographical things like earthquakes, in the 900s, 800s, in that period of time. But today there are still roughly about 7.5 to 8 million Maya living in that region. They're not occupying the Mayan sites, the ceremonial sites, but Mayan languages are 50 different dialects spoken, is really alive and kicking. And I think that is something that a lot of us picked out. And then I just got a few closing shots here that I thought characterized some of the aspects of the trip. You can't see me. I'm sitting up front, passed out too. This is Paul Love. This is the lake at Bacalar. So he's got the B and the other one got the A. And this is at Tulum, where we had kind of 2 days to unwind it on the beach, which was really great. And this is the ruins at Tulum, which was a fortress, a center of trade. And this is in Mérida, called the Monuments to Mexico. And this is just part of it. It eclipses kind of an entire circular block. And it tells the entire story of everything related to the history of Mexico. Now, of course, there might be elements left out there, but from the Maya to the Aztecs to the early missionaries to the conquistadors to the first Zapotec Indian or Indian president of Mexico in the 19th century, Benito Juarez, and all basically to the late 20th century. And I believe that is it.
Questions? They know how they quarried stones for buildings and really where they quarried it. I never saw any quarries there.
Well, it's all limestone, and it's brought in from different quarries that are, some of it is actually imported from, depending on where you are. If you're in the area of like Chichen Itza and Uxmal, there's a lot of limestone in that area. Areas towards Palenque, sometimes they have to bring it in from other areas of the north, which speaks again to that aspect of trade. But the areas near Chichen Itza and Uxmal are filled with limestone.
Questions over here?
I have two questions. You showed us the Red Lady. What was the pigment thing? And what was that all about?
I'm not sure what the pigment is. I guess it would have had to come from a pigment. A lot of the two typical Mayan colors that you see are that red and then a ocean blue. And a lot of the buildings, the temples themselves, were colored in those two colors and have just been eroded over time. But I'm not sure what they initially come from. Do you have a number? Yeah.
This is an area in Belize. I know we have a lot of what we call Campeche wood, and it's that kind of log wood, which they use for res dye.
Yeah. Should one more?
Yeah, I wanted to. He mentioned the quarrying of the stones. What did they carve from?
Usually, obsidian tools was the that was the
stone?
Yeah, that was the common tool that they used.
Questions?
Did you go inside to the center period of the pyramid inside El Castillo?
You mean up on top?
I guess there's another, a second pyramid inside.
Yeah, you're not allowed in. There is, you can see the entrance from up top, but they've closed it off entirely. Though there is one way to get in, and they have a really very poorly, it's very poorly protected in terms of how they've secured it, so it's very easy to walk over it and fall all the way down. So I guess theoretically you could get in that way.
What's that back? You mentioned it went to Bacalar. I was in Bacalar about 40 years ago. What's there today?
Not much.
Okay.
There are a series of hotels. Bacalar is that lake area that you saw the student jumping into the water at, and it is a lake that it's quite pretty, and it's also right by the lake is a cenote, one of those watering holes. So the two of them, it's kind of become a bit of an area where people get away from Tulum or a city just to the south, Chetumal, go for the day, go for the weekend. There are probably five hotels there, and the infrastructure is very, very limited, which might be a good thing. A lot of the noses, it's a really good point. I'm sorry I didn't bring it up before. A lot of the noses have just fallen off over time. So a lot of them, most of the ones we were looking at don't have noses anymore because they've basically eroded from the elements. They've not eroded, they just fall off. So you can see on the ground, if you go to like Kaaba, there are noses all over the place.
Are you planning, I guess the students would like to know, are you planning a future trip back to Yucatan?
We're definitely going to do this one again. So if anybody here is particularly interested, just... You're coming. Just let me know after, and I'll send you an email when the time comes, or there'll also be flyers up in the fall.
Well, one more, Taiwan?
This is not a question. It's only trying to make a point. We often say that the world becomes smaller because of the modern technology, transportation, but in those days, the world must be far apart, right? But, interestingly, so you said that they believe there are 9 layers of hell. In Buddhism, there are 18 layers, so that's just double it. And also the Chinese believe there are 9 layers of heaven. So that's very interesting.
And I think even things like the notion of there within the underworld, the part of the story of the ball court that I was saying before, there's something called the twin heroes, who are the children of the corn god, the maize god, who go down into the underworld to avenge their father's death. And they end up being born through an immaculate conception. So you have that element as well, which may be part of the reason why, another reason why the Mayan were more willing to accept Catholicism, because they saw some similarities. But I think there's stuff related to Egyptians that you can make parallels to.
Well, now's the time that we do the annual giveaway.
All right.
Free trip.
We're giving away a book on the Maya compliments of Barnes & Noble.
Inma Pertusa.
I know they want to join me. I'm on behalf of WKU Libraries and our kind host here, Barnes Noble, to thank Professor Dysgen. And I've left, I've actually spelled his name right at last. I added an H all year long. I know he's forgiven me. He's been deathly ill for the last couple of days. We certainly appreciate him coming out of his sick bed to talk to us all tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.